Welcome to Law Subscribed. This is your dedicated news source for all things subscriptions in the law. My name is Matthew Kurbis. I'm the subscription attorney, and I believe subscriptions can help bridge the access to justice gap and incentivize attorneys to modernize and scale their practice like never before. On this show, I interview lawyers ditching the billable hour and experts who can help attorneys move beyond billing time. Thanks to my sponsors, 650 and Gavel, links to both in the show notes, more on them later, and use the code LAWSUBSCRIBED when signing up. You get 10% off, and it supports the show. The best way to support the show is to share it with someone you know. This podcast is for educational and entertainment purposes only, and nothing said is legal, ethical, or financial advice. Without further delay, here's the episode. I'm thrilled to have with me here today on the Law Subscribed podcast, Brandon Harder of Lancaster Tech Law. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Matthew. Happy to be here.
Well, just in case my listeners haven't come across you before, or they're not ardent listeners of Legal Talk Network as I am, I heard you on the Lawyerist podcast, interviewed by Stephanie Everett, who is, of course, going to be, longtime listeners know, I'll be co-presenting with her at ABA Tech Show. I guess it will be in the past now, but at the time of recording, it was before that. And I was just thrilled to hear about the innovative things you're doing and that Stephanie highlighted you on the show. But and just in case my listeners haven't heard that episode, Brandon, please give yourself an introduction.
Sure. So Lancaster Tech Law is a small law firm here in central Pennsylvania. We do work for businesses of any size, business work, and a lot of civil litigation work. And that was really what prompted Stephanie to talk to me, because using subscription services in a civil litigation context raises some eyebrows. So,
absolutely, yes, it does. And when I was first going out there on my high horse saying how subscription can replace everything, that was where I got the most pushback, were from litigation attorneys that were like, yeah, right, like I'm going to not be billing time to do, you know, private practice litigation. So yeah, like this is one of the areas that is significantly unexplored from past guests on my podcast. We've had some various versions of segmented flat fees or payment plan like things that don't truly embrace the subscription model. But before we even get into those details, let's just go, like, let's hear even a little bit more about your story. Like were you, you know, you said you're a small firm, you know, were you always at a small firm? Did you go solo when you got started? Did you work at other firms? Like, what brought you to your current place?
Sure. Yeah. So I've worked for a number of other law firms here in the Lancaster area before going out solo about 18 months ago. And really, I went out solo because I have always had this fire for doing law a little bit differently, getting away from the billable hour model, getting away to something that's a little more predictable for clients. And while my last firm's partners were very supportive of me doing that, it made billing rip their hair out, because there was Brandon's billing and there was everybody else. And so we sort of decided, all right, I'm gonna run my vessel here on the side, because it makes a little bit more sense to do that. Yeah, so I've worked in firms of various different sizes. I worked for other people, was a partner at the firm I was at before I came here, and I'm here to sort of chart my own little course.
Yeah. I mean, that just sounds exactly like my experience, right? Like, my last firm was totally supportive of me doing an innovative billing thing, although it took a pandemic for them to be like, okay, so we're not in court every day billing time anymore. What were those ideas that you had? And to be fair, once they embraced it and we developed a model, but, you know, I still was expected to bill time. And it's just hard to build a practice in a practice, as you sort of said too. So very, very similar sounding story there. And I've only been doing it a little bit longer than you. So I'm coming up at the time of recording, I'm only 1 month away, 1 month and 1 week from my 2 year anniversary. So not much longer. So then, like, what was your process then? Like, what was your origin of the thought process of billing time isn't the way and subscription can be a valuable substitute for that?
Yeah, for me, it really started from the idea that client communication breaks down when the billable model is between you and the client, right? Because they're afraid, they don't want to pick up the phone and ask a question. They don't want to make one more change to the interrogatory. They don't want to do this or that because, you know, it's money. It's the old meme for every time they pick up the phone, you know, the lawyer's on the other end thinking, I'm thinking about you today, so I'm going to charge you some money. And, you know, it sort of disrupts a helpful communication. You say you want to be client focused and it's about you, and they have this impediment that they don't really want to talk to you more than they absolutely have to. And I want people to ask questions because, you know, we provide better services to people. We can give better outcomes. We can help anticipate things. And, you know, for good or bad, you know, you can say, oh, this is going to be a problem later in the case. Let's get off this train before we get further down the road. And so anything you can do to open up that situation, particularly with a lot of my litigation clients, are not repeat offenders. This may be their one experience. You know, their small business has worked on a handshake forever, and Now you got that one customer or that one other business who's causing a problem. So they're new and they need time to have explained, you know, this is what the process looks like and this is what this thing is and this is why it's there. And if they're afraid to ask questions, suddenly we have miscommunications about what this thing was or why this thing went that way. And so really finding a way to get that impediment out in the communication was the paramount thing that started me.
Yeah. But even that, why subscriptions? Was it you were, you know, you've used it before. You were just like, hey, I'm subscribing to everything else. Was there some book you read, some podcast you listened to, or like some article, or why that model specifically? Because flat fees, fixed fees have been around for a heck of a lot longer. So what was unique about subscription and your experience getting there?
So it actually came by crossing over from another industry. So I have an IT background before law school and do a lot of technical work. And so a lot of my business clients are in the MSP, the managed service provider sector. Mm-hmm. And I watched them, a lot of them switch from sort of a la carte or, you know, time and materials billing into some subscription models to have recurring revenue and to do different things with that and worked through with them what some of the hiccups were in their contracts and their relationships and providing professional services in that way. And, you know, one day it sort of just hit me on the head and say, wait a minute, why can't I do this? I mean, I'm providing a professional service. I'm anticipating what needs are going to be based on a number of different factors that I have to figure out. Maybe does anybody do this? Is this something I should do? And so we started exploring with the idea of how can I convert that from the IT world over into law?
Yeah. Yeah. And were you a member of Lawyerist Lab at the time, or is that something, or are you doing Lawyerist Lab? Is that how Stephanie found you? Like how did she even find you?
Yeah, I am a member of Lawyerist Lab. I actually was not at the time when I started doing this. I was doing that independently. And then in the process of looking for materials on, you know, what are the ethical concerns about doing it this way and going through, I ran into Lawyerist and it sort of sparked a conversation. So yeah, anytime Stephanie and I can get in a room, we start complaining about the billable hour almost incessantly and somebody has to break us up. So
yeah, yeah. And I mean, and don't get me wrong, I mean, there are innovative things firms could do that are still billing time, but like a lot of that cuts against potential billable time. So, you know, it behooves them to not do that anymore.
Sure.
I'm curious to know as well, because like what was there anything else out there? Because that is, I mean, absolutely, right? Like for me, heavily influenced by what other industries are doing and why can't law firms do it too? So, you know, you said you found Lawyerist, like what else is out there? Because I tried. I was in the same boat. I was looking for things. And like there was like one ABA article that I was able to find where it's like 10 lawyers doing it, but like all but two of them were selling like prepaid time. Like some version of that, right? And so like that wasn't what I was looking for. And so I started to talk to lawyers. I found Kim Bennett, who was, of course, the first guest, and she had all her materials out there. But did you find anything else out there? I'm asking personally, but also for a lot of my listeners, if they wanted to find other resources too.
Yeah, I definitely had some of the same frustration looking particularly like for ethical opinions or things about, you know, what you're worried about in the different bars. I mean, there's very, very little written, which either means that we are geniuses and on the cutting edge of something or they've already figured out something I haven't. But it hasn't burned me yet. So I guess maybe it's the first category. Yeah, I mostly had luck looking at attorneys who do it sort of individually, run their own firms. You sort of cold call people and say, hey, I see you're doing this thing in California. I'm in Pennsylvania. I'm not really a risk to you. Can we chat about how this is going on and go through some IP firms, intellectual property firms I saw do it that way.
Right.
Some of what Stanley Tate does with some of the student debt stuff is done a little bit in that way. Mm-hmm. So there are definitely options for firms that you can find. But yeah, resources are a little bit few and far between. The one thing I will say, though, is I find a lot of good ideas coming from even just the flat fee world, because some of the risks that they're talking about accounting for in terms of what happens if this goes overtime or undertime. I mean, flat fees are sort of little mini subscription plans. They're just little mini 1 month subscription plans, essentially, where they are absorbing the risk of, hey, this goes over based on a task. So you can get some guidance there as well. So I always make sure to pay attention to what they're talking about, particularly on the predictive end.
Yeah, whenever I'm doing a CLE and I ask for a show of hands for who's already doing flat fees in the room, and it's like, okay, well, you're so close. You're very close to being right. able to do subscription because, yeah, philosophically, you're kind of already there. You've decoupled time from money, right? Or at least that's the idea anyway. Very, very cool. And then any like non-legal resources you leaned into, like for me, I found the book Subscribed by Tian Zhou to be super illuminating on the subscription economy and different ways that different industries are doing it. Did you have any like other industry type books or resources that you came across or looked at when you were designing it?
Oh, I'm trying to think. The only one that's coming to mind is sort of the well-known, The Lawyerist Has a Small Firm Roadmap that I use to look at sure. how different things are structured and how things are priced. And I used a lot of the concepts of the client-focused model they talk about solves some yeah. of that communication problem that I was talking about earlier. So that's the one that comes to mind. But yeah, there's definitely a lot of good materials.
Yeah. And, you know, there's still like a gap between, and I'm curious to know if you're serving like the latent legal market, like the people who could pay something for legal services. And it could be a lot of money. They just want pricing certainty and they're not paying billable hour attorneys. So like for that market, I found since they've never even interacted with lawyers before, some of them are like, well, what's this? I have to schedule a call with you. Can I just call you? And like, I have to explain, well, one of the ways I'm able to offer affordable legal services on a recurring basis is that I keep my overhead super low. And so by not employing any staff people or answering service to pick up the phone all the time, I'm able to continue to offer you low cost services. Meanwhile, I found clients who have paid the billable hour and they're trying to like get a hold of their attorney and they call and people pick up and they're still never able to get a hold of their attorney anyway. They love the fact that they could just schedule calls with me once they're subscribed. So like it's like an inverse kind of a problem. Have you experienced anything like that?
Yeah, I definitely have. So the first subscription client I had was a sort of recurring client. It was somebody who has done litigation with me a number of different times. And I mentioned, hey, I'm testing out this subscription service. Can we go ahead and do this? And they said, well, how's that going to be priced? I don't know what it's going to be. I don't know what I'm going to do there. And I said, okay, how much did you budget for this case this year? And they told me, and I said, break it into 12. Let's just do that. So I guarantee you're going to stay on budget. They're like, oh, that's really good. If we can stay on budget, that sounds great. And I'm like, well, you already know what you're willing to pay for. You already know what you budgeted for it. So let's just get rid of the surprises. Let's get rid of the cash flow crunches as we go through this process.
And that's if you have that kind of a relationship with your client and you could trust that with the number they gave you is what they're actually willing to pay and they're not giving you a low ball. Or if you've set up your business in such a way that number makes sense and you already know your client's going to say yes. I mean, that is, yeah, I mean, why not? I mean, I feel like so many lawyers are just afraid to have that exact conversation with their client, right? So you said you've been doing it for, 18 months or so. So far, what has been your experience with the model?
So far, I love it. And for a couple of different reasons. So we do offer choices to clients. We do have some flat fee, sort of a la carte pay-as-you-go packages and some subscription packages. And you know, the predictability is great for the clients, but in particular, the sort of levelness of a subscription as compared to the peaks and valleys, which you definitely get with the billable hour, you get some with flat fees, depending on how much stuff happens in a period of time, definitely helps people. A lot of times, you know, just budgeting for what's my expense going to be, how's this going to be carried through. It also really helps have conversations up front about how much this process is going to cost. So often people, you know, they'll ask you, well, how much does it cost to file a complaint? And you give them a number. Well, how much does it cost to send, you know, this request? And you give them a number. And then you get to the end of it and they're like, well, this costs more than the number you gave me for the complaint. And you're like, yeah, because there was like a bunch of other stuff that happened between here and there. Oh, well, if I knew it was going to cost this much, maybe we would have done this thing differently. Well, okay. So how do you package that in a way that, you know, when we're talking about it up front, talk about what the shelf life is going to be of the subscription. And it helps people decide, hey, do I even want to be on this train or am I, you know, want to take something different? So yeah, it's a great client communication vehicle that way.
Flipping that question on its head, maybe would have been some pitfalls or some cons, if any, that you've experienced so far, any like bumps in the road with subscription?
Yeah. So I'll give you the one that I thought was going to happen and didn't happen. And then the other one. So the one that I thought was going to happen is I was going to have the needy client, right? The person who says, aha, I'm all in on this price. And I'm just going to like bug the heck out of Brandon. I'm going to ask a question every other day and I'm just going to do it and do it and do it. I had a handful of people and they'll do it for like a week. And then they're just like, I don't really want to talk to you about anything. Like they just run out of things to ask me about. And it turns out to be, you know, pretty stable. And even for, I have a subscription offering for business clients where I sort of work as their substitute in-house counsel where they just call me for, hey, is this a problem? Hey, is that a problem? you don't find you get overwhelmed by people as much as you would expect. There's only a set number of legal needs that they have, and people are usually pretty good about it.
And, you know, us lawyers, we're not that interesting. They don't want to call and talk to their lawyer all day.
They don't want to talk to the lawyers.
They have way more important things to do. I mean, I call it like fractional in-house or fractional general counsel.
Yeah, there you go. I
do the same thing. A term I wish I came up with that I didn't is like general counsel as a service, you know, play on SaaS,
that
right? GCAAS, right?
Yeah.
So there's, you know, there's that. And yeah, I mean, that, because that's kind of a no-brainer. That and like the IP continuing, you know, brand protection work that's out there, or they're registering copyrights a lot because they're a writer or they're a marketing company or something, right? So like the IP makes a heck of a lot of sense. Fractional GCE makes a heck of a lot of sense. And then, sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you on the con. Was there another part?
No, that's okay. So the actual con was handling sort of very sharp turns in a piece of litigation and how that process goes. So, you know, you file suit against somebody and all of a sudden there's a counterclaim that you're not anticipating and it's like majorly changed the scope of what's going on. Or they add a third party defendant who you didn't think was going to be in here, or whatever the thing is going to be that really slows it down. Trying to figure out, you know, there was a learning curve for, if I change the subscription price every month, they're like, well, this wasn't stable. Like, what the point of doing this was that it wasn't going to change all the time. And if you're going to keep changing it every month, like, that's too much. But at the same time, I had a tendency to let it run for a longer period of time than I should have before saying, this needs to adjust. We're sort of really, you know, running lean here on this, and we need to account for changes that were going on in a case. So I think having the advice that I would say coming from that was, communicate with clients early and often when you see something that, hey, this might change how we do the model. We'll let you know, so that way it doesn't feel like such a surprise if you get to a point where you have to have a conversation about it. And just sort of be mindful of what a client will see as a turn versus what an attorney sees as a turn, right? So adding a party or adding a claim, okay, they understand those things. If it's, oh, it got assigned to this judge, well, that's not really something that's going to necessarily go with them, or that they're going to understand that that's going to change, you know, the length of time you're going to spend on something. So it's finding those events.
That's really interesting. You know, I did litigation for 8 years and pivoted to full transactional. And at least one of the things I sell on my website is litigation avoidance, right? Like, I'm going to be litigating. I hated litigating so much. I mean, that's not entirely true. I really liked litigating and I was very good at it. And it's a heck of a lot of fun, but like, it's not good for people in society. The only people who really win are the lawyers in litigation, right? And so I try to avoid it wherever I can. And by deciding to not do it at all and sell litigation avoidance, I tell my clients, like, I'm not incentivized for us to not settle and resolve this dispute or potential dispute so that I can go to court and bill you a bunch of hours. I'm gonna have to refer that case out, like, because I don't handle that at all. So there's a part of it that's like that. But I did design, while I was at the last firm, I guess it was more like one plaintiff, one defendant type formula for how do you price a litigation on subscription and flat fee. So the way that I had initially envisioned it was, there's like initial price, then, and I want to know how you do it, but initial price, then there's the like a starting price, initiation fee, you know, for like other companies, other industries, right? You know, to file the complaint, because there's a lot of work like to get going, draft interrogatories, you know, do all the stuff that you do like right when you get the case. And then like 20% of that, or even less, depending on how you, you know, it depends on the market, is a monthly fee that you pay. And then you get a settlement fee. If you settle the case, you get a per diem or a per week fee if you have to go to trial. That's how I originally came up with it. And since then, because that was years ago now, that was actually even longer ago than I launched my own practice, I've come to learn, talking to people on this podcast, that maybe even what you do is you say, if we settle like within a year, I get paid a higher amount. And then if we settle in year two or three, it's a lower amount, to try to incentivize, you know, because the client wants to settle, maybe, if the client wants to settle. Sometimes clients want litigation to drag on. But, you know, like that. So like, there are ways to even adapt that model. And based upon what you're telling me right now, what I'm thinking about is like, can you adapt that formula? So it's like with every plaintiff or defendant or every additional party, like it like goes up by like 1.05%, like the fee, or like there's some like calculus there. And then for every claim, there's like a calculus. And when you first get the case, you know, I feel like you could build this formula where it's easy for you to price this to show your client, here's what happens. And you put it in your engagement agreement. And if these other things happen, we plug it into this formula, not just pulling it out of you know where. and the price is going to go up or down. Because what happens if somebody comes out of a case, somebody gets dismissed with prejudice, you can't get them back in, then your subscription price goes down, right? So, I mean, this is just off the top of my head, but have you been thinking about these kind of things? And like, what are you actually doing, Brandon?
Yeah, absolutely. So my subscription pricing started in an Excel spreadsheet exactly for that reason, because there were factors that you were counting in based on the complexity of the legal issue, the number of parties who were involved, whether it's in my home county here or it's in a surrounding county and there's travel involved, you know, the number of witnesses that we anticipate needing on both sides, all that sort of stuff to sort of come through and bake it to a number. And it definitely is a conversation to have about going up or down with a client. There are some ethical pitfalls if you keep charging the higher rate when there's no reason to be doing it anymore, when it exceeds what's reasonable for whatever the fee was. Right. So you definitely want to have something in there that's built for up or down. And I started the calculation that way. When I first did it, I didn't show the actual calculation to clients. It was sort of a behind the scenes thing that let me get to a number. I would usually give them a sense of here's an example of something that might make it go up, and here's an example of something that might make it go down, just so they had sort of an idea of what kind of factors were going into the pricing when it's calculated out. So that was more of how I did it than showing them the whole mathematics of it. A handful of clients want to know the whole math, and I'm happy to show them. But for the most part, it just makes people's head explode because they're like, I don't understand what all these dots are. Why are these things around here? And that's how we do the pricing for plaintiff side work when you're in there. And the euphemism I tell clients is, you know, litigation's like a highway and we're looking for the first exit, right? We want to get off this thing the first time possible. And so you as the plaintiff know that every month that this continues, we're going to spend more money. So let's try to get off this now, because all that's going to happen is you're going to keep spending money. On the defense side, sort of, there is a base one that we use, but then there's a little bit more of the calculation that you talked about, which was, you know, there's so much involved if I can get out of this in month one, and then it reduces in two and three and four and five as it goes through, which, you know, you can call it different things. I usually call it a resolution premium, which is, look, if I can get you the result that you wanted faster, I've saved you how many months worth of billing. And so usually I set it based on, you know, look, we're planning to do this for 12 months. And if we get done in month eight, then I'm going to take, you know, 40% of the remaining months that you didn't get billed. That gets added on as a bonus, and then, you know, whatever else is going on. So yes, you're paying less because we resolved it sooner, but you're not paying what you would have paid full price all the way through. So you incentivize sort of with a mathematical calculation for folks. If it's in the first 3 months, if it's in the next 3 months, it's not different than how contingency lawyers will sometimes do this percentage if it's before the complaint, this percentage if it's in the case, this percentage if it's at trial, same sort of thing, just inverted, because you want to incentivize ending earlier rather than later. So,
but there's something to be said about the client, whether they're plaintiff or defendant, having some skin in the game, actual skin in the game, right? So even I've been trying to advocate for this. Even personal injury attorneys should consider charging their clients even like $100 a month, and then that way they know that if this case drags on for like 5 years, they're still in thousands of dollars, right? And so they got to think about, okay, there's this settlement offer on the table, you know, and maybe instead of taking a third, they take like 30%, or they take 25%, or they eat the costs, or there's some way, like, you got to give some subscription benefit on top of just paying the $100 a month. So, you know, there's some kind of subscription benefit. They get like a reduced contingency fee, and then they're going to take that settlement offer really seriously if it's a good settlement offer, because that's a complaint that a lot of plaintiff's lawyers have. It's like, well, I'm just going to need a withdrawal from this case, and I've got my attorney's lien, and if anything happens, I'll get my percentage of a percentage, but they're not taking a reasonable settlement. I don't think it's worth the risk to continue to take this case to trial. And now they're screwed because the client's going to say, I'm going to roll the dice. It's not costing me anything.
Mm-hmm.
And what you just explained was such a great picture of, you know, they know. I mean, look, if you're, you know, if they're paying by the hour, they know it's costing them every time the attorney does some work or goes to court, but it's sort of more nebulous. And when they actually know exactly what it's costing them, if the thing drags on, that makes a big difference, I have to imagine, in the client's willingness to settle and try to resolve the case.
Sure. And if you think about it in terms of how lawyers, but human beings in general, operate, there's an incentive to do something when you're coming up on the deadline for something, right? There's this inherent pressure to make something happen, make some decision, make something move forward. So when you're coming up on, hey, we're about to go into another month, like, this is going to be another how many dollars, like, now would be a great time if you want to make a decision about what we're doing here, about getting on or off this train. Because I always found that towards the end of the discovery process and litigation, right? You've done most of the heavy lifting and getting the claims filed. You've collected most of what you want. There's this sort of no man's land where you run into cases that kind of stretch out because, you know, you don't necessarily have a scheduling order that's telling you you have to go to trial at any particular time. Neither of the parties really wants to force it or take that last deposition. And so the plaintiff is sort of indecisive, or the defendant, you know, whoever your client is, indecisive about what they want to do. And so what you end up with is just this file that's sitting there. And if they are paying the subscription, there's an incentive for moving it forward because it is doing something. And even if it's de minimis, I've done subscriptions where there is we were defending and the client doesn't want the case to move forward, right? All we're doing is watching the docket until the Prothonotary's attorney's office ultimately tosses it because the case is too old. But it has to cost something to continue to just watch and make sure that nothing happens in this thing. So we set sort of a maintenance subscription that they just know that's this many dollars for me to watch what's going on with this thing. And, you know, if you want me to keep doing that, that's fine. If you want to tell me I don't need you to do this anymore and disengage from me and you'll let me know if something happens, that's fine too. I just need to have a clear communication with you. Look, if you're going to have me do something, even if it's just check this docket, what's your skin in the game? What's that going to cost you to have this happen? Otherwise, they'll just say, no, you're my lawyer. Just stay here and just keep doing this forever.
Well, and the other side of that is there's a really good incentive for them to pay you even something de minimis, because if you withdraw as counsel, you have to notify the other side. And then they're going to be like, oh, I forgot about this lawsuit. I better.
There's a thing that filed. Right, we've woken up this big bear. Yeah, exactly.
Right. So like it behooves them that they should pay you something to maintain that thing. And look, there's value there, because look, if you're billing time and you're checking a docket, like you, even though like in a traditional sense, I guess like it's not like billable work, like substantive billable work. Like I don't think insurance companies would pay for check docket. Maybe right. They pay it at 50% or something like that. But, you know, you're going to bill that time anyway. And then in the meantime, I mean, for the way that I've designed my practice is, I'm curious to know how you do it with the scope of the engagement, even for litigation, is, you know, if somebody hires me to do their prenup, which I'm doing a lot of these days, because I make them subscribe first before they get access to the a la carte services, which for most people, they just need a la carte services. They don't need the ongoing, you know, higher level subscription tiers. Those are more for small business owners, even solopreneurs. But so I do use like a Costco model, like it's $20 a month. And as long as you pay the $20 a month, you get the subscription benefits, which includes below market flat fee rates and all that. So prenups are one of those things. So I let them know when they're subscribed, you know, if you have questions about something's happened at work, you get in an accident, you know, something else happens, or you're not sure about something, you know, I'm here for you and you can contact me about that. And that's part of what you're getting for the $20 a month, in addition to, you know, the main reason you hired me, where you're paying me, you know, $700 to take care of this thing for you. Because what I find, too, is when they do that, because that's a subscription benefit, they're bringing me more work to do where I could charge them another flat fee on those things, right? And so, like, when you're charging this client a de minimis amount, I'm wondering, like, you know, are they contacting you? Are they able to talk to you about other things? Do you have a different subscription package for that? Is it how are you handling that kind of stuff?
Yeah, so there is a different package that we do with our businesses. And when we set it up originally, we sort of jokingly were referring to it as the Amazon Prime of law firms. You basically pay this small amount to get, you know, free shipping on all of your orders thereafter. And so you keep buying things because you get free shipping and you like it and you do whatever. So it's a de minimis amount that you come and ask me about a thing and then you say, hey, do you want me to draft that? Okay. And then you get, you know, work that's profitable to go through and do that sort of thing. And for the clients I have who do that, yeah, I do it as sort of an open door. The way we worry about scope creep is I say that I will do one call or meeting on any new issue. So if something is recurring and it keeps happening, we need to talk about an engagement to deal with whatever it is. But any one-off thing that comes in, whether it's in my wheelhouse or not, you can come and bring it to me. It's going to be included as part of the price. If it's way outside my wheelhouse, got a DUI, I'm sorry, I'm going to find you a criminal defense attorney. This is not my bailiwick. If you want to talk to me about something IP or employment law related, sure, no problem. Let's talk about that as we go through and do different things. But I do encourage people, you know, sometimes you don't know if it's a legal thing. Sometimes it's a come to me and it's a go to your accountant. Like that's not a lawyer question. It's an accountant question, but they don't want to ask the accountant and they don't want to ask the lawyer because it costs money either way. So ask me first because you're already paying and then I'll send you where you need to be. So.
Right. And so, you know, we can only know what we know and we can only get competent in what we're able to get competent in. What I find, curious to know your perspective on this, is because I've got like the business clients, even this everyday people subscribed, they call me with things, and sometimes I might not know the answer to the question, but I think, you know what, another potential client might ask me that, and I could put it in like my knowledge base, which they get access to, but also just for me to have an answer to that question. And when they're subscribed to you, they're coming to you because they're already paying you, like you said, before it's a really big problem. You know, I like to analogize it to the plumber, where it's like, this is the leaky pipe version. And it's not even a leaky pipe. It's like a leaky faucet. It's like, okay, well, water is supposed to come out of a faucet, but I thought I turned the thing all the way and it's still dripping a little bit. Now, the legal equivalent of that, contact your lawyer. Now we could avoid a big, massive problem. And so it doesn't take very long. And the level of expertise that I need to give competent advice for the leaky faucet equivalent versus the burst pipe equivalent, I feel like I'm able to, I could take a CLE, I could look at some case law, I could take a peek under the hood and get a little bit of a level of expertise that I feel I'm providing competent advice. And then if I genuinely can't, or the issue ends up blowing up or it has potential to blow up, I'll refer them to that DUI attorney, right? So what's been your experience with that kind of thing? Like, what's your comfort level in like doing like a little bit more practice area? When I went solo, I pivoted from mostly litigation to a transactional-only practice. I did not have a database of documents to automate. That's why a business and employment legal document database and automation tool like 650 is super useful. I can rely on the quality of the documents in 650's database since they're putting excellent legal minds to work curating and updating their documents and automations over time. When you're not billing by the hour, outsourcing and efficiency matters, and 650 can help you scale your practice to get high-quality documents drafted in less time. Use the code LAWSUBSCRIBED at 650.com and when being onboarded to get 10% off. If you're not a business and employment attorney or you have your own documents that you'd prefer to use, then my next sponsor, Gavel, is the automation tool for you. Gavel allows you to build shareable, client-facing workflow and document automations. In other words, Gavel helps you create a legal practice where attorneys can monetize the value they bring clients in productized form and scale via subscriptions and flat fees. Use the code LAWSUBSCRIBED at gavel.io to get 10% off an annual subscription. There's no one right way to automate and scale your practice, but with one or both of my sponsors, 650 and Gavel, you can take your subscription law firm to the next level. Links to both in the show notes. Now back to the show.
Yeah, so my initial reaction to doing it was I was real big on the, gee, I don't know the answer to that, right? Because I don't want to reach into an area that I didn't necessarily know the answer for. And initially, I would just say, you know, that's beyond the scope of what I ordinarily do. I'm happy to research it, but it's going to be this much for me to take a look at the issue and get you a summary to come back. And then along the way, I did find that there were those sort of tangentially related fields that you ran into more and more often. You were doing something simple with immigration. You're doing something simple that's an employment law issue that's outside of the scope of what I normally do. And for those, sometimes it's worth, hey, let me take a look at that and I'll get back to you, right? I'm not going to take more than half an hour. I'm just going to look at the issue. And if I find a quick answer, I'll let you know. And if I don't, I'll tell you who you can call and I'll refer you to another lawyer to go and do it. So either way, the client knows I'm going to give you something of value, right? Either a referral to somebody who's going to know, or I can find the answer for it and, you know, build out the information that you have as you go along that way. So yeah, I've definitely been open to doing that. I try not to cross. There are certain lines getting into the estate planning world, which there's some tax implications that I don't necessarily want to mess with, in the criminal world I don't want to mess with. But so often law doesn't stay, you know, for at least for clients, it doesn't stay in these nice clean little boxes. And you have to be willing to test those edges a little bit.
Right, right. And I think the point I want to hammer home for the listeners is you're not learning a whole new practice area, but you're able to, you have the legal mind, right? Like this is when AI comes in and it's able to do so much more of our jobs for what attorneys are billing their time for, which you and I are already, we're ready for that because we're the subject matter experts, right? We're going to be able to go in and quickly use our training and legal expertise to find an answer to a question, especially as the tools progress. Which brings me to the next question I'd like to ask attorneys actually using the model. And you said you're solo, and I want to kind of ask you a compounded question here. So answer it however you like. You know, what technology are you using, you know, to power your subscriptions that you're leaning into as a solo? And then also, are you a true solo? Do you have any staff people? And like, how are you balancing staff versus technology and like and that whole thing?
Sure. So I'll do the second half of that first. I do have a couple of staffers who help me, a paralegal and a legal assistant who's remote and so isn't here physically with me in the office, helping just to coordinate communications and doing those sorts of things, keep the files in order. But everybody in my team has to be comfortable using, you know, any of the tools that we have available. So we have a practice management system that has, you know, everything in terms of storing documents and doing that sort of thing. We have a ton of templates I built out when we first got started for. I basically took every legal document I've drafted over the last 10 years, and I'm going to make it into a thing. Like if it's a brief, if it's a filing, if it's a contract, if it's a whatever. So that way you're not building from scratch, or, you know, it's great to find the template on the internet, but sometimes it's nicer to start with one that you were comfortable with. So taking the time up front to set those up. And then we also use generative AI whenever possible to make things go a little bit quicker. If it's a general letter, something like a ChatGPT, if you're doing legal research, something like Casetext Co-Counsel, to be able to summarize issues and to pull through and get some answers out the back end. Ask me again about co-counsel in a little bit, because I'm on the fence about whether or not I'm getting everything I want from that yet. But it's a good tool nonetheless to have those sort of quick answers come out as far as legal research is concerned. But not being afraid to, okay, here's an interesting tool that's being used in a different group and bringing that over here. So one of the ones that I've started using recently, and it's kind of been unusual, is Loom. Loom is a video recording program where you can basically screen share and have your face there and then be talking through things. I use it to explain complicated legal documents to clients. So like when we get an answer, I'll make a short video sort of scrolling through the document being like, don't worry about these things. This is legal nonsense. Here's the things you need to worry about. We got to look at these things. Take a look at the whole document, then give me a call and we'll go through it in detail, right? But you put a little bit of a personalized touch on, here's this document, instead of just, here's a thing, look at it. And then they're super worried about the first 10 pages, which are just denied as a conclusion of law and it doesn't mean anything. You can provide a little bit more substance so that they get, oh, okay, this is my lawyer's interacting with me, talking about this document, and then I can formulate my questions and come back. So anything like that to anticipate questions or anticipate client needs is also, I found to be really helpful.
And then for payments, is that also through the practice management platform? Are you doing something else to power subscriptions? How are you handling that?
We do all that stuff through LawPay to recurring payments and to handle processing for recurring credit card payments, that sort of thing, for the subscriptions.
Okay. And I mean, it says on your website, the practice management platform, I'm assuming it's a platform because you mentioned how you communicate in the portal. It's Smokeball. That's what you're using.
It is. Smokeball is the project management. It's the platform.
I want you to say the tech. It's okay. Like I have two sponsors of the podcast. Longtime listeners know Gavel and 650. They've been sponsoring me since very early on in the podcast. And so I'm happy to tell you how you could use those to improve your processes. I don't use legal practice management software,
sure,
because it's not designed for subscription. And in particular, the way I've designed my general transactional subscription-based practice, like none of them, I've played around with them, like none of them are well designed for what I actually want. So I don't use them. So I'm curious to know about Smokeball. Like, what do you think about it? Because does LawPay integrate with it? Because I know my case owns LawPay now. And so you have to go into two separate accounts to do that? Because all these platforms are made for billable hour firms.
They are. They are made for billable hour firms. It does integrate. It does play nicely despite the integration with MyCase. Although they're quick to tell you that if you were over in MyCase, this would work even better. But yeah, no, it does connect and it does do what it's want to do. For me, driving into Smokeball was really more on the litigation and the business end. The ability to have a bunch of tasks fire when something starts, right? A reminder so many days out, create so many folders in a file, create so many reminders in the back end. Doing all that sort of stuff with deadlines that were targeted and that sort of thing. That was what drove me to have a practice management tool that sort of organized all that sort of stuff. Mm-hmm. The other thing is, I mentioned earlier, my legal assistant is actually outside the United States. He's not even here in the country, and paralegal works remotely. So I had to have a platform where we could all be integrating, not remoting into somebody else's computer or doing something complicated, sharing documents and doing that sort of thing. And so rather than trying to build up, you know, OneDrive or DocuShare or other sorts of platforms, we can do all that document management inside Smokeball. So really, I just have to have people in this one platform day in, day out, right, to be able to communicate back and forth.
Right. I mean, it's, you know, it's one of those things, especially in litigation. I'm able to find non-legal tech solutions to do the things that I want to do for what my practice management are, but there's no better solution for litigation than a legal tech solution, right? At the end of the day.
Yeah, it sort of drives you at the end of the day. There's just a thing about, you know, calculating so many days, not including holidays and weekends. Oh, it does it automatically. That's what I wanted it to do. Okay, fine. Right. You got me.
Right. So, and then with the templates, I'm curious about, is that also like a Smokeball feature? Are you using another tool for that? Or are these just in Word that you've templatized these things in Word? Like, what are you using for that?
Yeah. So Smokeball integrates really nicely at the desktop level with Microsoft Word and Outlook. So from within Outlook, you can save stuff in a Smokeball and come back and forth. And with Word, they let you create a template that can pull fields from Smokeball, so-and-so's name, so-and-so's address, whatever it is. But it's otherwise all the bells and whistles that normally come with Microsoft Word. So you can do all the formatting you want. You can set the styles up the way that you want them to. You can have captions pull the way that you want them to. You can have page, whatever other stuff you want to have it go along. So really for me, what it was is taking existing documents, making them a little bit generic, and then just finding the places where there were fields to insert, like in captions and that sort of thing. But other than that, I didn't have to like recreate the whole document and a thing. I didn't have to play with the formatting extensively. They let me stay in Microsoft Word and, you know, keep all the stuff that I built out over years of, you know, fighting with styles and everything else, which is lovely in Word. But you didn't have to reinvent the wheel. And I liked the ability to not worry about, I don't remember what it was. One of the document automation platforms I used a number of years ago, a cloud-based one. And I was always terrified about what was going to happen when I hit convert to PDF, because I didn't know what I was going to do to the form. It looked fine on the screen, but like the one time it did something I didn't want it to do. And so now I was, you know, instantly afraid of this tool because it was going to screw something up when it was important. And, you know, knowing that I'm starting natively inside Word is just like a sigh of relief for me. I'm like, all right, I know what this is going to do when I hit print. I'm where I'm safe.
I mean, it's really important. Look, if these tools are working for you, that's great. You should keep using them. But I want to give you the benefit of having come on the podcast, like me, like hear what you're using. And I talk to a lot of lawyers using technology. Obviously, two legal tech platforms sponsor the show. But like one that isn't a sponsor, I talk about them so much, I should really talk to them about sponsoring the show, is a LawPay competitor. It's called Confido Legal. It used to be Gravity Legal. I don't know if you've
come across. I heard of Gravity. I didn't hear the new one.
Yeah, so they recently rebranded to Confido Legal, and unlike LawPay, they don't charge you a monthly subscription to use it. And it's powered to do trust accounting, right? To hold on to client funds, so it could pay for it out of an operating account, right? Because that's their design for legal payments. And they power subscriptions. So like you can power your subscription payments through that too. And, you know, ACH payments are lower than the credit card and debit card payments, right? Which is true of any of these platforms. Like, and look, I only use them for trust accounting because my platform integrates with Stripe and I'm using Stripe to do it because I'm not. But if I ever need to hold on to client funds, I send a link through, I almost wanted to say Gravity, but through Confido Legal to do that. But I know since I'm in that tool that they do this, they can power subscriptions too. And if attorneys come to me, I'm thinking, like, and they're like, I want to do a subscription. I tell them, like, you should check out Confido Legal because it could just power your subscription. Then you can figure out practice management system stuff later, even if it doesn't integrate. You know, so it depends on your comfortability of using those. For my templates, I am using Gavel. I mean, look, they are a sponsor of the show, but I learned about them before they were a sponsor. I had the CEO on before they were a sponsor. And what they do that's really cool, if you've already got templates, is they have a marketplace where you could turn around and sell those templates as well, either to end users potentially, or even other lawyers, right? And you can find other ways to monetize those documents that you've automated in Gavel, which is like a really cool thing. And they have a plugin into Word, just like Smokeball does. So it's one of these things where the ease of use, if your clients are already putting all their information into Smokeball, maybe it just makes sense to keep doing what you're doing. But I would definitely give Gavel a peek. Since you're doing the business stuff, I've been leaning on another one of my sponsors, 650. They have their own documents and they do their own document automations that they build. Now they're a relatively younger company, but they spun out of Wilson Sonsini. So they're coming out of a law firm. I mean, they've been separate for, I think, a while now, but they're still a relatively young company. They're very open to feedback if like you don't like something in an automation, but that's their only job. So like you're paying them a monthly subscription and like they make sure the documents are up to date. I go to all their, they have tons of free information too. I go to all their things and there's updates in law that are applicable to my clients and they update the documents whenever there's like new employment stuff. So you might be able to find that you can learn a little bit about employment law. They've got all these employment documents on there for every jurisdiction and you might be able to start competently providing employment legal services by using this tool. But they also have other business docs too. And if you use the code LAW subscribe, you could save 10% on your monthly subscription.
There you go.
They are a sponsor.
Yeah, no, but that sounds great. And it solves one of the problems, which is you know, the employment agreement I wrote 5 years ago might have been good 5 years ago, but you still have to spend some time updating and fixing and doing those other sorts of little things. That's why some of the IP management solutions, you know, do a good job of doing that. So yeah, that's definitely a cool one that I'd like to take a look at.
Definitely check them out. I think I'm talking with them about actually having one of their founders on the podcast too in the future. So we could even learn more and do a deep dive on that episode coming soon. And then for generative AI, what I highly recommend, and this episode is releasing this upcoming Friday, so really dedicated listeners can figure out when this interview actually took place based upon when this releases, but it's Paxton.ai. They did just start charging, though I'm pretty sure there's still like a basic like freemium model, Paxton.ai. And there's a lot of good AI tools out there, and they're all good for different things, but you know, you talked about case text, and Paxton wasn't originally designed to be like a case text competitor or Lexis or Westlaw competitor, but because what they did is they trained their models on all state and federal laws in the US, and it ended up just being a really amazing legal AI tool, like a generalized one when they were training it to do like SEC financial regulatory type work. And so they now let you do like legal research type stuff. And I think they're charging now like $99 a month. But for me, it's a no-brainer because like I was using it every day anyway. I don't have to hire an associate to like do all the stuff. And you could write the letters in it. And you could write first drafts or improve first drafts of contracts. And you could do the legal research. So it's just like a broad general legal AI assistant tool that I found just helps me leverage my time so much better. So definitely check out Paxton.
Yeah, I mean, some of the issues that I've had using particular tools is sometimes they're too siloed, right? This is good for legal research. This is good for drafting. This is good for something else. Something like Paxton sounds great where you can sort of live in it, because the more you stay in one environment, the more comfortable you get, the easier it is to use, and you know, the more efficient you can be, and especially for subscription clients where efficiency is really what you're shooting for at the end of the day.
Right. And sometimes I'll upload the contract to Paxton and I'll have like a prompt that I like to use to get an analysis very quickly for what are problematic clauses for my client. And it'll pump out a result and I could get them here's AI quick review, and I could get that to them in minutes. Right. Hey, you sent me this document. Here's the AI review to start thinking about it. I'll be able to get human eyes on this in a couple of days. Right. In a few more days to get back to you. But then they get an answer right away. They're super happy. And I found that while it doesn't get everything, it will find some things that I maybe would have missed. And what I really like about it, although a lot of these AI tools are starting to do this, is it suggests really good follow-up prompts. So it's like, you know, yes, I do want to see that clause redrafted in a way that more favors my client. And I don't have to type in that clause, because at the bottom of the response, it has like four or five recommended follow-up prompts that I could ask. And I might have come to those on my own, but first of all, I don't need to type them in. I could just click it and get the answer. And then also sometimes there's some suggested prompts that maybe I wouldn't have come up with on my own. And so like that's a really powerful aspect of that tool, which I know some of these other tools are starting to lean into things like that. But I could tell you that the quality of in my experience, I got to get them to sponsor too, because like I talk about Paxton, I do a lot of guests, but it's just one of these tools I'm using every day. And it's super, and I use it for anything you'd use Gen AI for, because it's all legal trained and it's all legal context area. Sometimes I'll throw things into ChatGPT because I want it to be a little bit more pithy or interesting. And ChatGPT does a really good job of like creative, clever, interesting.
It's good for writing, board meeting minutes and making up some silly language you can stick in there and see if anybody actually read it and do some of that. So
Right. So those are just my recommendations based on the technology that you're using. And man, I can't even believe we're already almost at time. Let me know. Do you have to run? Because then I could ask you my last couple of questions.
Whatever you need. I'm here for this afternoon. So
okay. So we kind of already talked about Gen AI, and you already mentioned a little bit about how you're using it, because I know that's the topic du jour. I want to know your perspective on your ability to, and we sort of touched on this earlier, like represent clients who maybe traditionally wouldn't have gone and hired a lawyer. They either would have filed something pro se or defended pro se, or they would have been a business owner who was just like, lawyers are too expensive. Like, are you trying to target those markets, and what's your success there? Otherwise, are you more institutional clients just disrupting the billable hour?
Yeah. So what we're doing right now is institutionally targeted, but absolutely long-term, what I'm hoping to be able to do, right, especially with small business clients and with individuals here in the Lancaster community, is if you can streamline the tool enough that you can offer it at a price point, you can reach this whole segment of the market where people don't invest in a lawyer at all. And they try to wing it or do whatever they're going to do, and it causes problems, and it, you know, it does other sorts of things. And it's almost a, you know, I would like to finalize sort of a self-guided tour with a lawyer at the end of it who could help, you know, tweak this or that or the other thing. You can put some information in, generate some documents back out. In the consult, not only are you going to tell me about the thing, but you're going to walk out with, you know, here's the complaint that you could use for the DJ's office or whatever the case might be. Absolutely. And I think that comes from using tools like generative AI to enhance what an individual human being can do, right? It's not about, and I argue with people about this all the time. It's not about replacing a lawyer, right? It's not about replacing a lawyer with an AI, just like it's not about replacing a doctor or do anything else. It's about, can it do 90% of the work and let me focus on doing that last little piece? Or can it mention something which, if I sat here long enough, I would think about, but maybe in the moment when I'm looking at it quickly, I don't think about. So, hey, have you looked at this other topic? Hey, have you thought about this other issue? Hey, have you asked this other question? And if you get comfortable with those tools to the point where you can really streamline the services that you deliver to people, you know, it doesn't even take an hour's worth of work. It doesn't take, you know, necessarily a large block of time to be able to do it. And that's really what unlocks the ability to get to some of those underserved markets where the traditional lawyer model, just frankly, from some perspectives, costs too much even at the ground level, right? Even starting, it doesn't make sense to go in and do those sorts of things. If you can find a way to capture 80% of your expertise with tools and then come in for that last part of it, now you've made that accessible to, you know, those other sorts of markets that are on. So yeah, long-term, that's where I'd love to be.
Right. And we can't think about that if you're just billing your time and that's the only way you make money. So it requires this paradigm shift. How do you handle like multi-jurisdictional practice? Like, you know, especially for the, you're not going to court clients, because the going to court clients is obvious. You got to be licensed in that jurisdiction. But for like the business law clients, well, IP is federal law. I mean, they're state law, but it's federal practice, right? So I guess you could do that. But then what if they have like jurisdiction specific questions that are not IP related? Like, how are you handling like multi-jurisdictional representation?
Sure. I don't think the answer is, oh, well, you need an answer about what Texas law says, so I'm not touching it and go to Texas, right? Certainly you can warn people, hey, look, I'm not licensed in that jurisdiction, say the disclaimer and do all that sort of thing. But a lot of times there are parallels between states and you can use resources. CaseX is what I'm using at the moment, but you can use resources that compare various different state laws to be able to give an opinion on it, or even use a generative AI tool, which is why I said CaseX is what I'm looking at right now. Hey, under this state's law, give me a summary of what's going on. And then you can look at that. You can look at a case or two and then give an answer. So I'm usually not afraid to talk about, unless it's something very, very unique. Like you look at some law and you say, look, I don't have anything like that in Pennsylvania. I don't have any idea how this is applied. You know, you shouldn't be afraid to advise a client. The normal circumstance where it comes up for me is I have a client here in Pennsylvania who's signing a contract with somebody out of state, right? And they say, well, they want their home state, not our state's laws to apply. What's the difference? Does it matter if we use California law instead of Pennsylvania law? If we use Colorado law? Well, you have to sort of look at both to be able to tell what the difference is between the two. I think you give a disclaimer saying, look, I'm not licensed in that state, but I think at the same time, the tools are ubiquitous in a way that you can quickly make yourself comfortable with what a legal issue is in another jurisdiction.
Right. Right. Yeah. Yeah. You just got to leverage the tools. I think I agree with that. Although I say even like if you're representing somebody in your jurisdiction who's doing business with somebody in another one, I'd say that's even less gray area because like you're here, your client is here. It's like when you get like you have an IP client from California and they're doing a transaction with somebody in Colorado, like that's where it starts to get a little bit right. Like, okay, so yes, IP, it's a licensing deal, but now we are applying state law because the state law is going to control in, you know, in the contract. So like that's maybe a gray area where I don't know if you've come across that yet, but like, yeah, I don't know. I don't know what the right answer is. And I wish that the bar associations and the licensing jurisdictions here, it's our Supreme Court in Illinois who does it. I wish they would like give us some more flexibility in that regard when we're not going to court, when we're not going to court for somebody, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Well, the first question I would ask is, how did you find me? Because I'm all the way over here in, you know, farm country, Pennsylvania. What are we doing from Colorado that you're reaching out? But
look, I've had people from Pennsylvania reach out to me, Brandon. And the reason why is I post my very affordable prices on my website.
That's true. That will attract people. So,
right. I mean, it attracts some of the wrong people sometimes, but it's like, hey, look, I do say, and on my onboarding, that's all automated. You got to be in Illinois or your transaction has to be in Illinois for me to be able to help you out. So yeah, putting affordable pricing on the website is definitely a way to get those folk. I wish I had an IP practice, but I'm simply not. It's too tough for me to pivot into that these days. I'm already doing enough. My last substantive question for you, then I got a fun one for you, is I have found that us lawyers who are doing things differently and disrupting the billable hour, that I'm trying to find a through line. And certainly the most common one that I found, which doesn't apply to me and you, is it's mostly women attorneys and attorneys of color who have ditched the billable hour to do subscription and flat fee. And I think I've had a lot of those conversations on the podcast is why the billing time does not work for those demographics. And then for the other lawyers like me and you, like I'm also trying to still find like through lines for like what's the connective tissue between all of us. And this is, I think, also true of some women and attorneys of color. Some things that have come up, and I'm curious if any of these apply to you. A first generation attorney, like you don't have a bunch of family members who are attorneys. Neurodivergence, so like maybe like your brain just works differently than like other lawyers or the average person. And then some other sort of maybe, you know, you had a certain life circumstance or something happened to you, or your own experience hiring a lawyer and realizing how expensive we could be. Like, do any of those resonate with you, Brandon?
Yeah, I mean, I think the greatest through line that we ever had was the pandemic, because it sent everybody home and they all had to figure out how to do something different.
Good point. That was an immediate easy sell.
So setting good that point. One aside, because I do not wish for another pandemic just to make it easier to sell subscription to my fellow colleagues. We'll find other ways to do it.
Yep.
The other thing that I found really successful are attorneys who are looking to bring in sort of new associates or new lawyers into their firms, and they can't figure out why they can't keep associates or why it's so hard to recruit associates, or they're finding things. And part of the answer is, well, people are looking for something a little bit different and you're looking for the wrong people. You're excluding a segment of the potential lawyer pool who need a slightly different working arrangement or could do other things perfectly profitably underneath your umbrella, can do it ethically, all those sorts of things. If you were a little bit more flexible about how much revenue are they generating instead, are you at your desk from 9 to 5, right? Because that really limits the pool of candidates that you can get. And so, you know, I tell people, look, if you want to have an easier time hiring somebody, look at a bigger pool to hire from. And, you know, to do that, you have to sometimes accommodate other needs and other systems.
Right, right. I mean, and that's like the neurodivergence thing, which is not just autism, right? It's like ADHD or ADD or other sorts of attention related things. Like there's all kinds of different neurodivergence. But yeah, like these are lawyers who have a really hard time billing time, you know, in a traditional environment. And I've never been tested, though I certainly identify as neurodivergent, though I have no doctor that will give you a certification that I'm somehow neurodivergent. But I'm also a first-generation lawyer. I don't know, Brandon, do you have lawyers in the family?
I don't. I'm first-generation as well, so.
Yeah, so I think, you know, I think that's a through line, right? So, like, we don't have the dogma of, like, or the functional fixitist of this is the way it's always done, because we weren't taught that, because our family doesn't, we don't come from lawyers, right?
Yeah.
So I think, yeah, I think, and you know, I'm not, you know, I'm just, it's a correlation, not causation, right? But
mm-hmm.
I still think
mm-hmm.
it's an interesting thing. So with that, I'll ask you my last question I like to ask all my guests, Brandon, and that is a hot dog a sandwich and why?
Oh, so a hot dog is not a sandwich for two reasons. One, because if you put the bread on the top and the bottom of the hot dog, it just looks ridiculous. So that's a prerequisite to a sandwich. And, you know, that doesn't work out so well. The second one is my son will not eat sandwiches, but he will eat hot dogs, and he tells me he doesn't eat sandwiches. So apparently in his, you know, 5-year-old mind, there is a clear distinction between those two things. And who am I to judge if that's the distinction that he's drawn?
You know, that more and more people are bringing up what their kids say, which is really something, because they're just like these early large language models, right? That are like figuring out language, right?
Exactly.
They
haven't overthought it.
okay. So two rare follow up questions to this. I accept your answer, but yeah, realizing you're not in Philly, but you're in Pennsylvania. Is a Philly cheesesteak a sandwich?
That is a sandwich.
Okay, even if it's on like a sub, like it's not like on like a two separate.
It can be on a sub because that's its own special creature. So yes.
Okay, interesting. And then my kid, well, is a hamburger a sandwich?
Ooh, that one's tough.
Well, let me tell you, while you're thinking of that, my kid, who at the time she was only like 2 and a half. But we made burgers for everyone, and she wasn't eating burgers. She was eating mac and cheese or something. But like I was like finishing making, like bringing in stuff from the grill, and there was a burger sitting there for me and my kid, who was like 2 and a half. She was an early talker. She's small. She's like tiny. She makes up for it. We could say she's small but mighty. She was like, "Daddy, you need to eat your sandwich," referring to the hamburger. right? She's older now, but at the time I was like, huh, I never thought of a ham. I thought it was, you know, sui generis, which is what I've heard about a hot dog before. Like, it's a unique thing. It's its own thing. But yeah, I mean, I think a hamburger is more like a traditional sandwich than a hot dog is more like a traditional sandwich, right?
Yeah, I think on the gradient, it's definitely closer to a traditional sandwich. I'm trying to think of the other criteria that I would use. And, you know, if it looks like a duck and it quacks like a duck, maybe it's a sandwich. Might be how it is.
The kid rule, because I will tell you, there have been some parents on the show that say their kids say that a hot dog is a sandwich.
Oh.
And so, you know, you never, you know, it's all a matter of perspective. It's less about, you know, what you answer than how you answer it. So if anybody wanted to follow up with you, Brandon, what's the best way for them to do it?
Sure. Easiest way is to check out our website, LancasterTechLaw.com, or to shoot me an email. It's my first name, Brandon, @LancasterTechLaw.com.
All right. Well, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me.
And that's our show. Thanks again to 650 and Gavel for being sponsors. The best way for others to discover this show is for you to share it with somebody you think would find value from it. Follow me on LinkedIn, since that's where I'm most active on social media, and click the bell towards the top right of my profile to get notified about all of my posts about this podcast and everything else I think is valuable for you to see. To get in touch, message me on LinkedIn or email kurbis@lawsubscribed.com. All links are in the show notes. Until next time, this is Matthew Kurbis with Law Subscribed.